The myth of Jewish passivity during the Nazi Holocaust.
There has been I would say an underreporting or a lack of writing, a lack of discussion about Jewish resistance in the Holocaust. There has been some. I knew a little bit about the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. Well, I knew it happened. That's kind of all I knew. But the rest of the story of Jewish resistance, in particular, I found in Poland, where I focus my study, has just been really underlooked. It's not been written about or talked about very much at all. And even all these years later, I think, you know, people still, even subconsciously, even myself subconsciously, still carry a myth of Jewish passivity in the war.
That's Judy Battalion. We talk with her about her book, The Light of Days, The Untold Story of Women Resistance Fighters in Hitler's Ghettos. Then another World War II story, this time fiction, told through an unforgettable cast of characters.
I think the way I write books is that I may have a setting and I've usually got a rough idea of the arc, but the way I really write it is to get to know my characters and to sit inside their heads and look out. And as I get to know them, I often find that the plot that I have planned for them doesn't actually work because it doesn't fit with how they develop during the course of the book. And therefore, I often find that when I'm writing the top of a page, I don't know what's going to happen in the second half of it, and that characters will suddenly emerge, or a character that I have just touched upon will become instrumental or key in the book. For me, it's all about the truth of a plot coming from the characters.
That's Lissa Evans. We spoke with her in 2015 about Crooked Heart, her novel set in wartime London. Now she tells us about V for Victory, the sequel. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. In 1939, more than 3 million Jews lived in Poland, making up one of the most vibrant Jewish communities in Europe. When World War II ended in 1945, 90% of them had been murdered by Hitler's regime. The Nazi extermination program was implacable, but it did not go unresisted. Young people, and especially young women, who had been active in the Jewish youth movement before the war, fought back against the Nazis. They cared for the sick, brought food to the hungry, and mounted operations of rescue and refuge. They also carried out military-style campaigns of sabotage and assassination. They didn't expect to survive, and most didn't. But some did. After the war, they found the world wasn't interested in their stories of resistance, and even many of them just wanted to put it all behind them. Their heroic history went underground like their own resistance during the war. But now that hidden history has been brought out of the shadows by my guest Judy Battalion's book, The Light of Days, The Untold Story of Women's Resistance Fighters in Hitler's Ghettos. The world has taken notice. The book is on numerous bestseller lists, including the New York Times, and Steven Spielberg has already optioned it for a major motion picture. Judy Battalion, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
This is just a terrific story, The Light of Days, the untold story of women resistance fighters in Hitler's ghettos. First of all, just a little bit about you. You're an art historian by day, a comedy writer by night. What inspired you? How did you get into writing a book about Jewish women of the anti-Nazi resistance?
Good question. At the time when this project began by accident, and it began 14 years ago when I was indeed working in the art world by day and as a stand-up by night. And I was living in London at the time, and it was a time in my life where I was exploring my Jewish identity. I am the granddaughter of Holocaust survivors. And I was thinking a lot about what I call the emotional legacy of the Holocaust, the way that trauma passes through generations. My own life, I'm a very anxious person. And I guess I was thinking about how my Holocaust heritage was shaping my behavior, was shaping how I both perceived and reacted to danger. Everything around me felt very dangerous. And so I wanted to explore this idea in really a performance piece, but I wanted it to have some kind of historical backbone. So I decided that I wanted to write about strong Jewish women who had confronted danger. And the first woman to come to mind was someone I had studied in fifth grade. Her name was Hannah Senesch. She was a Hungarian Jew, very young in her, about 20. She moved to what was then Palestine in the 1930s. But during World War II, she decided she wanted to fight back. She joined the Allied forces. She became a paratrooper, and she volunteered to go back to Nazi-occupied Europe. You know, I'd grown up studying her as a hero, a legend of Jewish bravado. But back in 2007, when this was beginning, I decided I didn't want to know about Hannah Senesch, the hero. I wanted to learn about Hannah Senesch, the person. I mean, who does that? Who chooses to go fight the Nazis? What is the psychology behind that? What is the personality? What motivates such audacity? So I wanted to find a nuanced biography of Hannah Senesch. And that led me to the British Library, where I, you know, ordered whatever books they had on Hannah Senesch. There weren't very many. And I went to pick up my stack. And I noticed that one of the books that came out for me was an unusual book. It was an old, dusty book. It had a blue fabric cover with gold writing on and it was in Yiddish. It was called Frauen in die Ghettos, Women in the Ghettos. But I would say even more unusual than the book is the fact that I speak Yiddish. So I started flipping through this book, you know, intrigued, looking for Hannah Senesch. Was there some, you know, what did it say about her? But I couldn't find Hannah Senesch in this book. In fact, she was only the last few pages. In front of her were 150 pages listing dozens and dozens of young Jewish women who fought the Nazis, mostly from the Polish ghettos, with chapter titles like Weapons and Ammunition and Partisan Battle. And both in terms of tone and content, this stunned me. This was like no Holocaust story I'd ever heard. And I knew then I had to do something with this. And that is how it all began, serendipitously.
Wow, that is just a terrific story, just right in there. You know, very early in the book, you say we have a resistance to resistance. What do you mean by that?
There has been a I would say, an underreporting or a lack of writing, a lack of discussion about Jewish resistance in the Holocaust. There has been some. Of course, I grew up, I learned about Hannah Senesch. I knew a little bit about the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. Well, I knew it happened. That's kind of all I knew. But the rest of the story of Jewish resistance, in particular, I found in Poland, where I focus my study, it's just been really underlooked. It's not been written about or talked about very much at all. And even all these years later, I think there's still, you know, people still even subconsciously, even myself subconsciously, still sort of carry a myth of Jewish passivity in the war.
So let's talk about this resistance. You say the resistance, and these were really young people. These were like high schoolers, college age, you know, late teens, early 20s, and you say the resistance was born out of the labor Zionist movement. Tell us about that movement in Poland.
Well, the resistance was born out, or the resistance that I write about in this book was born out of the youth groups. One of the types was labor Zionist movements, and they become sort of a focus in my book because I found out a lot of information about them. But there were many youth groups in Poland in the 1930s. In fact, 100,000 Jewish youths in Poland were members of youth groups. And this is before the war. The youth groups were kind of like the scouts, but more so. These were intellectual, social, spiritual, emotional, value-driven training grounds for Jewish youth. And they were affiliated with different political parties or political stances. And I focused in my book primarily on the socialist, secular youth movements. And so they really valued equality, egalitarianism. Women were leaders in these groups. They were all about self-sufficiency, physicality, working the land. And they trained even in self-defense, some of them did. And they were socialist groups. They believed in collectivism, in collaboration. Many of them read. They had reading groups. They studied psychology, psychoanalysis. They learned to speak and analyze their dynamics, their strengths, their weaknesses. They really learned to work together. In fact, many of these groups, young Jews left their family homes and moved into communes, kibbutzim, with their youth groups. These were all over Poland. So these youth movements, many of these Jewish youth, these were value-driven. They believed in Jewish pride and the pursuit of truth and passion for their heritage. And they also really trusted each other. They had formed very tight-knit bonds. And these were then the groups that became the underground militias in the ghettos. They were almost primed, even though these were groups of creativity and socialism and charity and social work. The dynamics that had been sort of set up, the way that they were value-driven and collaborative, really primed them to become these militias in the ghetto.
Yes, I mean, those were skills working together, even the sense of egalitarianism, especially given that this is a book about women resistors. Now, tell us about one of those resistors who you focus on, although there are a number of just incredible people in this book, but Renia Kay, tell us about her.
Sure. So Renia Kukielka, she was 14, just turning 15 when the war began. She had been a top student at her Polish public school. She had studied to be a stenographer. She actually just started working in the town court when Hitler invaded. She was defiant in the ghetto from the start. Jews were imprisoned in ghettos, but she would leave and trade family heirlooms for food at the risk of death. She tried to help refugees in the ghetto. Her family knew they were going to be killed, and she fled. By herself, she ran through fields. She had a good look, they called it. She had light hair, lighter eyes, so she could pretend to be non-Jewish. She could pretend to be a Catholic Pole. And she did that. She was trying to find places to live, places to hide. She was once recognized on a train. She picked up her valise, walked to the end of the train, and jumped right off. She finally found a job as a housemaid for a part German family. But she really wanted to meet her sister. And her older sister, she found a way to connect with her. And her sister got her smuggled to this town of Bijin, where her sister was part of the underground. And the underground in Bijin wanted to stage a rebellion in the ghetto. And they needed supplies. They needed information. They needed weapons. And all the couriers who had been bringing them this had been killed. And so they needed someone to go to their headquarters in Warsaw. And they asked Renia, since she looked good. She could pass for being non-Jewish. And she said, of course, I'll go. And so she became what were known as a courier girl. And these were young Jewish women, their late teens. Renia was 18 by now, early 20s, who disguised themselves as Catholic Polish women. They called it was a 24-hour-a-day, nonstop acting job, a life-or-death acting job. And they would slip in and out of ghettos, bringing information, bulletins, underground papers, letters, money, fake IDs, fake Aryan passports and travel papers, making arrangements for rescue, and procuring and smuggling weapons to arm these ghetto militias. Rania met with arms dealers and, you know, bought guns, taped them to her torso, put explosives in her bag, had money in her undergarments, and would get on trains and go back and forth between these towns. She also helped rescue some Jews. Many of these courier girls helped other Jews sneak out of ghettos, and they helped them find hiding spots and then took care of them in these hiding spots.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Judy Battalion about her book, The Light of Days, The Untold Story of Women Resistance Fighters in Hitler's Ghettos. Yeah, it's an amazing story. In fact, one male resistance fighter said that the Jewish girls were the nerve centers of the movement. What were some of the other things that the Jewish women resistance fighters did, aside from courier?
So, first of all, they were the nerve centers in many ways because it was easier for women to work on the outside, they called it, on the Aryan side, outside the ghetto. It was easier for Jewish women to disguise themselves. So because they were not circumcised, they had gone to public schools more often, they spoke better Polish, they were more acculturated and assimilated. And as women, they were trained to listen to other cues, to be coy, to be flirtatious, to be aware, to be playing to the other. And these were all skills that helped them go undercover. So much of the Jewish women's work happened on the outside of the ghetto. And when they say the word the nerve centers, what she was referring to was that they literally connected the communities. They were the ones on trains and by foot connecting these locked ghettos. Bringing information, bringing news. Jews in the ghettos didn't have radios. They weren't allowed newspapers. It was often these young Jewish women who even brought the news of the Nazis' genocidal plan. They were telling the communities what was going on around them. But I've also traced a number of other roles of Jewish women in the resistance. Some of them in the ghetto, they ran soup kitchens and orphanages and underground secret schools, even secret summer camps and performances. They also printed underground bulletins, edited newspapers and wrote for various resistances newspapers. And then there were also Jewish women who were assassins, who shot Gestapo men in the head, who blew up Nazi supply trains, who were ghetto fighters, who participated in uprisings and flung Molotov cocktails and threw explosives at Nazi tanks.
Now, you mentioned before the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. That's, of course, one if we have heard of any resistance. And I think, like you, I that's the only instance of resistance that I ever heard of. I mean, and clearly from your book, Judy Battalion, from The Light of Days, this was far more widespread. But talk about the Warsaw Ghetto and tell us also about Zivia and Zivia's girls.
So Zivia was a Jewish leader. She was a leader in the youth movements before the war. And in fact, when war struck in 39, when the Nazis attacked, she fled east like many young people, in fact, like my own grandparents. And she was actually beyond, she was in safe territory. But another Jewish woman, her friend Frunke, another leader, wanted her back. And she said, no, she must go back. And she smuggled her back into Nazi-occupied Poland. Zivia went to Warsaw. She became a leader as well in the Warsaw Ghetto, negotiated with Polish, German, Jewish leaders and councils, helped feed and teach and get young Jews pulled out of prisons and slave labor. And she had a group of, they called them Zivia's girls. These were some of these courier girls, and she would send them out on missions across the country. She herself looked very Jewish, had a Jewish appearance. So she did leave the ghettos as well, but she couldn't always. So sometimes she would send her team of girls. And again, they would connect the ghettos, bring information, bring supplies, bring back information as well. Zivia became a leader, as I said, in the Warsaw Ghetto, in the movements, and in the Warsaw Ghetto uprising. She was at every head committee meeting and part of the strategic planning. The Warsaw Ghetto uprising was a highly planned and strategized uprising. By the way, I didn't know any of this before I started work on this project. And it appears there are about 750 young Jews who were guerrilla fighters in the uprising. And they were young. They were all late teenage, early 20s. And they were organized into units, often based around which youth movement they were from. And they had various military strategies. They often attacked from the roofs. They worked with explosives. It was really a planned and organized uprising.
Let's take a little bit of a step back and kind of the prehistory of the uprising, because you talk, Judy Battalion, in The Light of Days about this whole, the push and pull between resilience and resistance. These young people saw so much horrendous death and torment around them that they all expected to die. I mean, they expected to die in the Warsaw Uprising, but even before that, talk a little bit about their psychological state in developing this resistance. And they also faced resistance from Jewish leaders, even other members of the Polish resistance. You know, so they got a lot of pushback, and they had really no military training. I mean, they had the other kinds of skills you talked about, but not military training. So talk about this whole psychological push and pull that they felt, and how they ended up with this military resistance to the Nazis.
I mean, I think psychologically they felt that they really, the youth groups that I wrote about, they really, you know, they're at their, one of their core values was acknowledge the truth around you. And I think it was very important to these young women that the truth that they saw it, they knew all the Jews were going to be killed. They really accepted the truth of that, that other leaders often didn't swallow or just couldn't see or didn't want to see. And that is why they pushed for, they knew they were going to be killed. So these were suicide missions. They, in fact, in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, they were shocked that when they survived. They hadn't planned bunkers for themselves. They hadn't planned food supplies. They assumed they would be killed. The psychology, I mean, they were filled with fury and grief, and they needed to fight. They were passionate. And the fight also gave them purpose and camaraderie, but they were fighting for freedom. They were fighting for dignity. They were fighting to help rescue who they could, but they were also fighting to die with dignity, to die leaving a legacy of courage, leaving a legacy of a fight.
You say, or someone said, that they were fighting for three lines in history. They had, for young people, they had a very acute sense of their historical importance.
It was a big part of their training in these youth movements. They talked a lot about history and Jewish history. And they, you know, one of the early resistance efforts was they printed an anthology of stories and a nonfiction fiction of Jewish heroes throughout history and distributed that around the country. That was very important to them.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Judy Battalion about her book, The Light of Days. It's the untold story of women resistance fighters in Hitler's ghettos. Now, talk a little bit about the emotional legacy. I mean, of course, many of them were killed, but several of them, including Renya, you know, lived to a ripe old age. You quote at the start of a chapter by that name, The Emotional Legacy, that we had been liberated from the fear of death, but we were not free from the fear of life. What did that person mean by saying that?
Well, for many of these women, liberation was, they talk about it as the worst day of their lives. Of course, what they experienced in the Holocaust was horrific and traumatic, But being part of an underground gave them purpose. It also, that fury and energy, it helped bury their grief. And the end of war for them was a moment of reckoning, of realizing that their families had all been killed. Most of their friends had been killed, their siblings. They had nothing. They had no home. I'm talking about young people. They didn't study for a career. Often their countries didn't even exist. The worlds that they'd known, the whole world that they knew didn't exist anymore, and had been literally brutally murdered. So they had to recreate their lives, and this was not necessarily easy. And I write about a number of different women. So people had different mechanisms for how to do that. For some of them, it was immediately through helping others, immediately through setting up organizations to help other Jewish survivors, other refugees, to help them move on, even in their new countries, to help them reintegrate or integrate at all. For others, it was about leaving the story behind, leaving their past behind, starting fresh. They needed to do that in order to move forward. And for others, it was too hard. The experience of trauma was simply too difficult. And they, even though they had survived the Holocaust, they did not survive surviving.
In fact, a lot had survivor's guilt.
They had pungent survivor's guilt. Some of the reason we don't know these stories, there are many reasons, but one of them is many of these women felt that they because they'd been fighters, because they felt that they hadn't had it that bad compared to their fellow survivors who had been through Auschwitz. They almost felt like they didn't have a right to tell their story because it wasn't as bad as what others had. They hadn't suffered enough. The survivor's guilt was really debilitating for some.
And you talk in this book, In the Light of Days, Judy Battalion, about, I mean, before we spoke about why resistance stories are unheard, you talk more toward the end about why the stories of the women's resistance were particularly not known. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the reception in Israel, where many of them did go, to the stories. You know, that was very interesting, kind of the controversies between those who had been, as you noted, you know, survivors of the concentration camps versus those who had been resistors, and particularly why women's resistance was so undervalued.
Well, I think this goes for America too. Women often felt disbelieved. I have one quote of someone who they told, "Don't tell your story to journalists; they'll think you're insane." Women were often, and I heard this many times, there was this kind of sense that the pure souls perished, but those who survived did something conniving to survive. They were collaborators, or they had slept their way to safety. They did something. And so that also forced many women to turn inward. Many of them were, there was accusations that they had left their families to fight instead of caring for their parents. And that also was a guilt that weighed heavy on many of them. I think also these were women, they felt a great duty to have children, to repopulate the Jewish people, to remake their families. And I think they wanted, you know, very badly, with good intention, to raise children in a world as happy and normal as possible. And for that reason, too, they themselves repressed these stories for a long time.
And what about for you at the end of writing this book? How had you changed, maybe, in some of your thoughts or feelings, even about yourself?
Yeah, I think that, you know, when I started this interview, I told you that I started this whole project with this question about the emotional legacy of and the trauma that passes between generations. And I think what I've come out of this feeling is, yes, I do think the trauma passes, but also what passes is strength. strength and courage and passion and compassion. That too has passed through generations. And I too feel a great pride in my heritage.
Well, that's beautiful. And the book is just a terrific read. The Light of Days, The Untold Story of Women Resistance Fighters in Hitler's Ghettos. Judy Battalion, it's been a privilege to talk with you about the book.
Thank you so much for having me and for asking such thoughtful questions. Thank you.
Judy Battalion. Go to writersvoice.net to find links to her New York Times op-ed, The Nazi Fighting Women of the Jewish Resistance, and much more. Next up, an unlikely duo faces the London Blitz together. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Back in 2015, we spoke with Lissa Evans about her novel Crooked Heart, a black comedy set in wartime London. It told the story of a precocious 10-year-old orphan, Noel, who's taken in by a small-time con artist named Vera when he's evacuated from the London Blitz. Now, Evans has come out with a sequel, V for Victory, and it's actually the third in a trilogy. We missed the first one, Their Finest Hour and a Half. Noel is 14 going on 15, and he and Vera are still together, facing down the Blitz in a large house next to Hampstead Heath, where Vera has taken in lodgers, barely scraping by. The story of those final days of the war, along with revelations of secrets the two have been hiding for years, is told by Lissa Evans in her signature, poignantly comic touch. Evans is the author of 6 novels for grown-ups and 3 for children. Well, Lissa Evans, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much.
So this novel, V for Victory, is the third or is it the fourth in a series?
It's a third. The third in a loose trilogy.
Okay, it is a third. Because I was reading in a British paper about Old Baggage. Is that another novel entirely?
No, the novel that's unrelated is Their Finest Hour and a Half, which was the first historical novel I wrote. And then I wrote a book called Crooked Heart. And then I wrote the sequel to it, which is Old Baggage, the prequel to it, which is Old Baggage, and now I've written the sequel. So I wrote the middle book of a trilogy first, unusually, and then I went and wrote the prequel, and now I've written the sequel.
Right. Well, so we last spoke with you about Crooked Heart. Sorry, we missed the first one, Their Finest Hour and a Half. Orient us to this story, since this one, V for Victory, is the third in the trilogy. Yes. Orient us to the story.
Right. First book I wrote in this trilogy, Crooked Heart, is about a 10-year-old boy who grows up with a very eccentric godmother. He lives with his godmother on the outskirts of London, on the edge of Hampstead Heath, which is a beautiful, wild area in London. And his godmother is a former suffragette and a very, very eccentric figure who has brought him up to think in an original and radical way. And right at the beginning of Crooked Heart, his godmother, Mattie, is failing. It's the beginning of the war, and she's starting to suffer from dementia. And in the prologue, she becomes more and more ill, and Noel, the little boy, at the end of it, is left on his own. It's the beginning of the war, and he is evacuated. And he is placed in a household which is about as radically different from the household in which he grew up as possible. It's the householder is a woman called Vera Sedge, who lives with her mother and her wastrel 19-year-old son. And Vera is always desperate for money and isn't too moral about how she gets it. And Noel, who at that point is a grieving, almost mute little boy, lands with her and is awoken to an interest in the world again by realizing that he's living with someone who could do with a bit of help in terms of how she operates her scams. So he helps her in her illegal job of collecting money for fake charities, and they become a sort of team, and then they become more than a team. They become a sort of mother and son by the end of the book. And I finished that book and I realised I wanted to know more about Matty, the woman who had brought Noel up, the former suffragette. So I wrote a book about Matty set in the 1920s about what did suffragettes do afterwards? What do you do after you change the world? What do these vigorous women in the prime of life do next? And then I've written V for Victory, which follows Noel and V at the end of the war, 1944 to 45, the last year of the war. And that's where it's set.
Well, first of all, it sounds old baggage sounds quite interesting. I'll have to check that one out. But now to go back to what you said about Vera and her scams, you know, she's not at all a bad woman. And in fact, the scams, you know, it's interesting. I've done a fair amount of research into World War II. Everybody stole because that's how you were able to survive.
Well, there's an element of that. I mean, I wouldn't go as far as saying everybody stole, but there was certainly crime during the war. But I would also say that Vera actually has a very wobbly moral centre, I'd say, especially at the beginning of the book. She acquires a stronger moral sense, I think, during it. But she's somebody who is prepared to cross over the line into illegality probably more easily than most people. She's always on the lookout for a way of making money illegally, but is too scatty, too nervous, too disorganised to actually pursue that route very successfully. And it's Noel's clear brain that enables her to do so. But certainly reading about crime during the war, yes, there was a lot. There was a lot of looting of bombed houses. But on the other hand, looting could be defined as actually picking up a piece of coal that had been in the fireplace of a bombed house. That could be defined as looting. Picking up a piece of string, that could be defined as looting. So it's not always breaking into jewellery boxes. You know, there was a very fierce definition of crime.
Right. And I actually was talking also, as I thought of it, of occupied countries like in Holland during the war, where the straits were even more desperate, but they were pretty desperate then. Let me ask you, this trilogy is set in wartime London. What draws you to this period?
Well, I've been interested in it since I was about 12 or 13. And what happened was one Christmas, my older sister, who at that time was a sociology student, she bought a book for my father, and the book was called How We Lived Then. And it was the first time I think somebody had collected a whole load of reminiscences of what it was like to live on the home front, which is a phrase much used in this country, and I'm not quite sure about the US, but basically means civilian life during the war. And it was a book which had brought together memories and reminiscences. And my father looked at it rather askance and said, but why do I need to read this? I lived through it, which, of course, he had been a young man during the war. But I took the book instead at 12 or 13 and read it and reread it and reread it and was completely fascinated. It wasn't a political book. I've since read, obviously, vast amounts about the home front, including quite detailed sociological studies. But this book was just a book of what it was like to live then, what kids would have in their Christmas stockings, what it was like at school, where would you go on holiday during the war, would you have a holiday, what would you feed a pet? This kind of domestic detail, which I've always loved. And I was so fascinated by it that I read it so many times that it gave me a kind of baseline of knowledge about the war. It almost as if I had memories of my own. I mean, I was born in 1960, but it gave me such a good depth, a basis. And so what happened was when I wrote a couple of my first two novels were roughly contemporary. They were sort of set in the 90s. And then I was thinking about writing a book set behind the scenes in television because I used to work in television. But I had my doubts about whether anybody would really be interested. And then I read a book by a interwar film star called George Arliss, now forgotten. And in it, he just in passing said, once work begins in studio, nothing outside is of any relative importance. And I thought, oh, gosh, that's so true. You know, when you're working telly, it seems even trivial things seem so important. And then I started thinking about well, what about if what's happening outside the studio is incredibly important? What if bombs are actually dropping outside the studio? Will people inside it still be obsessed with, you know, the colour of the leading man's tie or whether they've got half a line or a whole line taken out? And I started researching and I could see that, in fact, very little had changed as far as writing and acting was concerned. And that even when shrapnel was hammering on the roof of the studio, you got all that interaction between writers and actors that I knew so well. And I thought, oh, I'm going to write a book about a film made it during the war. So that's how I started off being a historical novelist, really. I didn't expect to. And so more research on top of that really compounded my interest.
So let's go back to V and Noel. I mean, Noel is quite a precocious young man. As we meet him here in this novel, he's not quite 15. So he's not a little boy anymore. And V, you know, V seems to be doing a pretty bang-up job of mothering him. Tell us about their circumstances and how she takes care of his education.
Well, V and Noel live in the house that Noel grew up in, which is a large Victorian residence on the edge of Hampstead Heath. It's a very unlikely part of London. I think it used to be Henry VIII's hunting ground, but now, of course, it's incorporated within London and surrounded by houses. But nevertheless, it's about a square mile and a half of heathland. It's wonderful. And there are these houses almost in it, and they live in one of those. And Vera is making a living by taking in lodgers. And she has five or six lodgers at any given time. But it was a time, the last year of the war, when the Hitler's rockets, as they were known, were landing, V2s they were called. And there was masses of death and destruction on a daily basis. And people were leaving London all the time. So V is perpetually worried that she's going to run out of lodgers and therefore run out of money. But this is made even more awkward by the fact that Noel refuses to go to school. He had very unhappy times at school. So she uses the lodgers to educate Noel. So she chooses them not only on the basis of solvency, but on what they can teach him. So there is a cashier with the local council who teaches him maths and statistics. There is a doctor who teaches him biology and chemistry and accuracy, as she puts it. And there is a journalist who teaches him English. And therefore, his knowledge is picked up from various sources, and he also self-educates. He goes to the few museums that are still open, and he buys books. And so his knowledge is incredibly wide and eclectic, and he is also very, very good at getting on with people in his slightly eccentric way. He's a connection with everybody in the book because he is very likable. He's an odd boy, but a very likable one.
And, you know, what struck me is that, you know, some books really focus on the plot. I wouldn't call this one of them. What really stands out are the characters, as well as the setting, which you've talked about already. And talk about, you know, the character development in this book. Why is that really, I'd say, the focus of the writing?
I think the way I write books is that I may have a setting and I've usually got a rough idea of the arc, but the way I really write it is to get to know my characters and to sit inside their heads and look out. And as I get to know them, I often find that the plot that I have planned for them doesn't actually work because it doesn't fit with how they develop during the course of the book. And therefore, I often find that I don't, when I'm writing the top of a page, I don't know what's going to happen in the second half of it, and that characters will suddenly emerge, or a character that I have just touched upon will become instrumental or key in the book. For me, it's all about the truth of a plot coming from the characters. I mean, I love domestic drama, and therefore my books have been described as lacking in plot, but for me, I think loads happens. I mean, there's loads of incident in them, but there isn't sort of an overall mystery or a missing inheritance or something. But there are the kind of incidents that happen to people, and there are the kind of interactions that happen to people on a daily basis, and that's the joy I take in writing is developing my characters and having my characters come across each other and finding their own voices and using dialogue for character rather than for exposition.
Yeah, I was struck by what you said earlier in our conversation today, which is that you wanted to know more about Noel's godmother, Maddie. So you wrote a book about her. You know, it's what is that interrelationship that you have with your characters in the sense that you see them? I mean, are they're how do I want to put it? Do you see yourself to some degree as a channel for them, or, you know, what is the binary relationship?
I think when I first started writing, certainly in my first two or three books, all the characters were in some way an aspect of me. So, you know, the meanest part of me, or the most biting part of me, or the kindest part of me, or, you know, I would channel an aspect of myself into a character. But I think as I've written more, I can make up in a way characters that aren't me anymore. But I very rarely say I would channel them, but perhaps I will make the exception with Matty, who jumped onto the page fully formed on page one of Crooked Heart. I hadn't even thought about it. When I thought of the book, I thought of a boy staying with an unlikely, you know, foster carer. I didn't even think of his godmother, but she appeared on the first page and I knew exactly how she spoke from the moment she appeared. And I never had any problems in writing Matty's speech. So perhaps dialogue is a key for me, that I the way characters speak, and that may come partly from the fact I worked in radio for many years. I wasn't a radio writer, I was a producer. But when you look at a radio script, the way they're set out in the UK, the characters' names are along the left-hand side, and then there's a gap, and then there's the dialogue. And you should be able to, in a good script, cover up the characters' names and still know who's talking. And I think that influenced me very strongly. And I like each of my characters to have a voice. And I think that voice leads me to them.
And we're speaking with Lissa Evans. Her latest novel, it is the third in a trilogy, is V for Victory. So there's another character that you introduce here who almost has a kind of parallel plot that comes together at a certain point. And that is Air Raid Precautions Warden Winnie Crowther.
Winnie Crowther. In Old Baggage, leaping backwards now, Matty, the former suffragette, sets up a girls' group on Hampstead Heath where they sort of run around and throw javelins and debate and try to train themselves as modern women. And so I had all these little girls in that book, and I knew when I wrote V for Victory I wanted to bring back a character or two from Old Baggage. It's very nice looking through, thinking who I would like to see again, because these little girls would now be in their 20s in this book. And in Old Baggage, there are twins, 10-year-old twins, Winnie and Avril. And Winnie is slightly fat and plain and very much put upon by her sharp, clever twin, Avril. So I brought those two back with Winnie as my heroine. And Winnie is 26 and she tried to make it as an actress and didn't succeed, and then married in a whirlwind relationship a teacher right at the beginning of the war, who then went to Dunkirk. Her husband Emily went to Dunkirk and was captured and has been a prisoner of war camp since 1940. So she knew her husband for a total of about 3 months, and she now hasn't seen him for nearly 5 years. And in the meantime, she has become an air raid warden. And she also has a slightly fraught relationship with her ghastly twin, Avril, whom I very much enjoyed writing, who is very good looking and smart and has written a book, a rather sort of sexy book about air raid wardens, sort of nicking all the information from Winnie as she does so. But what I liked about Winnie was, I mean, she's a very ordinary person in many ways. I think I most like writing about ordinary people, but she's doing a job which is hard and which is also sometimes dull. And I did want to write about air raid wardens because, you know, they're often laughed at, and I myself have had a couple of, you know, villainous air raid wardens in previous or at least annoying ones in previous books. But I wanted to write about their job because it was, they were immensely brave. But a lot of their job was administration. It was going around people's houses to see who lived there at a particular time so that if there was a bomb, they'd know who lived in a particular street. It was lots of making sure fire buckets were filled or pumps worked or they could get a telephone to phone the fire brigade if a bomb dropped. And I wanted to highlight that kind of job because, you know, they also serve who only stand and wait. And Winnie's in that kind of job which never gets the spotlight and yet was so important. And so I highlighted that. And there's a part of the book where a bomb actually does drop, a V2 rocket drops, and Winnie's in charge. And I really enjoyed writing that. And I took inspiration from a particular book I read years ago now called Raiders Overhead by a woman air raid warden called Barbara Nixon, who wrote with great vividness about her job and made me want to highlight it.
And then there's another character, a kind of love interest for V, Corporal Mario O'Mahony. I thought to myself, he must have an Italian mother and an Irish father.
Italian mother and Irish father, that's what I thought, yes. I did enjoy writing him. I'm always, you know, very careful about, I know British idiom and British voices so well, and it always slightly scares me when I have to write somebody, you know, somebody from abroad, American in this case. I wanted it to feel convincing. He's a big broken-nosed character in his 40s who's basically joined up to see the world, and he's a driver with the US Army. And it was very, my previous books set during the war are set before the Americans came into the war, so this gave me my first opportunity to meet GIs. And what was very, very noticeable was, you know, aside from many other culture shocks, was how well paid and how smart GIs were, how they had money to throw around, and how they were much, much better dressed than British soldiers who were in their wrinkly old baggy khaki. And the American uniform was very smart, you know, with a tie and a, you know, all fitted. And they earned something like 3-4 times more than the average British soldier. And, you know, the glamour of it and their access to incredible food, you know, and the rumours of what went on at the Rainbow Rooms, which was the GI's club in central London, where, you know, people would throw away half-eaten hamburgers or have your cream in milkshakes. You know, it was like dreams of paradise for London people living off, you know, rabbit cutlets or whatever. And V, you know, meets her GI. It's not the romance she thinks, but neither is it unhappy. I wanted him to be a benign presence, and when he turns up for Christmas Day at the house, it's like Father Christmas coming. He's got crates of booze and fantastic food. He's got a turkey from somewhere, and he, you know, he's a benign and lovely character who changes her life, but not in the way that she anticipates.
You know, you said about the lingo, although you didn't use that word, you know, American way of speaking. I have to ask you about something that jarred me when I came across it. On page 85, Noel is selling golf balls that he's picked up, and he sells them to the lone golfer on the golf course. And when the man tries to bargain with him, he sticks to his price. And then the man buys them, saying, "I've been Jewed, no doubt."
Yeah. I've been Jewed, yes, absolutely. There was masses of anti-Semitism in London. You know, I can't gloss over everything. And, you know, even during the war, there was anti-Semitism and rumours about, you know, Jewish people going to the shelters first or hoarding things. Anti-Semitism has never left this country. And that would be an absolutely typical comment at the time. And it is jarring, yes. But on the other hand, if I don't put that in, if I don't occasionally do that little jar, you'd think people were the same, you know, the attitudes were the same then as they are now. And they weren't. They absolutely weren't.
Yeah. And then there was another case where Noel refers to redskin war drums.
Yes.
Were you aware of using those words that now are, you know, close to verboten?
Yes, I was. I mean, I try not to do, you know, there are lines I will not step over, but people use a different vocabulary and thought in a different way. And that wouldn't have been seen then as in any way offensive. You know, that we're not talking about somebody who was being rude to someone. That would just be a something he'd seen at the cinema, something he'd read in a book. It wouldn't even occur to him that that would be in any way offensive. So
that's, it's so interesting because, I mean, I'm so glad you did explain this, because it wasn't clear to me whether you were aware of what these characters, you know, what, how that would sound to somebody.
Oh, Frances, of course I'm aware. You know, as if, I mean, the word redskin is absolutely unbelievably unusable and offensive nowadays. But it wouldn't, I use the Jews phrase to really just show how much anti-Semitism there was then. But in terms of Noel's comment, it wouldn't have occurred to him there was anything offensive about that. For him, that would just be something he's read about. And although, of course, I censor it to a certain extent, you can't take up all of the attitudes of them. But I also can't pretend that cultural references are unchanged. And I think it wouldn't feel true if I did.
Well, this has just been a delight to speak with you, Lissa Evans, as V for Victory was a delight to read. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Francesca. It's been my pleasure.
Lissa Evans. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with Dr. Robert Okun about his book, Ending Parkinson's Disease, A Prescription for Action. And Lionel Shriver tells us about her dive into the pros and cons of ending it all before age and decrepitude takes it away. Her new novel is Should We Stay or Should We Go? Don't forget to visit writersvoice.net to subscribe to our free podcast and weekly newsletter. And if you're already listening to the podcast, give us some love on your favorite podcast app so others can find our show. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @writersvoice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.